compels me.
What the fuck's the matter with these cunts? What's the matter with them? That must be like some fucking mega ego trip, these guys.
We got horses and bloody ducks.
The whole part of being a rock star is being a rock star. And what the rock stars do, you get a limo, you get a Learjet, you got people running around licking your ass.
I get nicknamed Nibby.
I looked at Phil Ward and he had this big long beard. And I said, you look like a pen nib. The Stone.
Hello, I'm Azubis.
Very strange, and Geezer in particular has all sorts of weird dreams and weird thoughts. And it might have been the acid, I don't know.
All right, here we are, another episode of Sabbath Bloody Podcast, Sabography for the masses. I hope you're all doing well out there. Just last month, I premiered the show, got two episodes out quickly, dipped my toes into the podcast void. And I'm getting a bit of feedback now. It's all been very positive and helpful so far. No cyberbullying, no trolling. Seems like people are digging the show some. I'm going to try and get one of these out a month. So keep checking back if you tuned in. Let's go get on the road into the lovely caravan from 1970. Busy ass tour too. We'll cover the support of the debut and Paranoid here.
It is a funny story. I think those stories are kind of best in the caravan.
Got my little timeline printout here for 1970. So the boys have been doing a lot of gigging since becoming Black Sabbath. And around this time, it's just, you know, get in the van. No Learjets just yet. You can picture it as black van, cloud of smoke bellowing out as they emerged from it, all dressed in black themselves, the crosses around the neck, long hair, just fucking epic, I imagine. Actually, Tony talks about the ride in his book here. The first thing that the band bought was a huge Comer van with blacked out windows. It was a wreck. An ex-police van that had a great big hole in the floor on the passenger side. I once used the van to pick up this girl. We had put a carpet over the hole, trying to do it up a bit. She came in all dolled up, stockings on, climbed in the van and went straight through the floor. The metal ripping her stockings and cutting her leg. So that was the end of that romance. Shit, poor girl. The van broke down constantly. It was shit, but the roads were shit as well back then. To go to Carlisle or London seemed like a never-ending journey. As I was the only one with a license and we couldn't afford a chauffeur, I was the only one driving it. I'd pick everybody up to get to go to rehearsals and gigs, but because it was all down to me, I'd get absolutely shattered. So we're all lucky to even have survived that, really. They'd all be asleep in the back and I'd be slapping my face trying to stay conscious. The worst thing was, when I opened the window to try to keep awake, they'd go, "Oi, it's cold back here." So yeah, that's their tour bus at the time, DIY style. So let's burn through some timeline here. Okay. Friday the 13th, 1970, Black Sabbath, the album, is released. They play the night of the release in Workington at the College of Further Education. It's a Valentine's dance, actually. Aw, that's adorable. That's a lovely gig right off the bat there. Anyway, so Valentine's dance, ripping out War Pigs for the slow dance, no doubt. Then we jump to March 4th when they go to Cologne. So they're still drawn in Deutschland at this point. They play Bletchley? I don't know where that is. Sounds English, though. He doesn't put countries on here. I guess I could look it up. Doesn't matter. March 9th in London. That's England for sure. The Atomic Sunrise Festival. The Roundhouse Chalk Forum. So nice. Some early spring festivus time here. That's some mud and drugs, probably. Other bands on the bill. Quintessence. Never heard of them. Gypsy. There you go. Proper hippie fest. I haven't heard of any of these bands. So anyway, back to Birmingham, March 11th. Then back to London. They play the Marquee. They play there a lot over the years. Must be a steady gig. It's actually a pretty well-known venue. It used to be a real showcase spot for the UK scene. And you got Manchester, Bradford, London. So they're playing to more and more people at this point for sure, but still the UK. Okay, so this is where I got a little eyewitness story to read here. Bear with me. This is March 18th, 1970, and this story is taken from Black Sabbath Online, which is a fucking incredible website. So this is a story told by a chap named Phil Oswalt. Here he says, "Me and some buddies hired Earth for £40 to play at an end-of-term dance in the school hall. We then asked them if they'd do our final year dance the next year. They said yes, but asked for £70, so we said okay. Off they went. We figured we'd like to have a gig off school site, so we booked a dance hall called the Cosmopolitan. Earth had gone back to Birmingham, and rumors trickled up that they'd changed their name to Black Sabbath. We kind of thought, what's that all about? Heavy metal didn't exist then. Big names were Cream and Hendrix, so we didn't know what was going on. Anyway, we weren't too worried about the gig. The next bit of news was that they had gotten a record deal with Vertigo. We weren't surprised, as we all thought that they'd make it somehow or another. It was getting closer to the day of the gig, which was March 18th, 1970. The next thing that happened was their first album going onto the charts. Wow, everyone was into it, and it was great that they'd made it. There'd been a single before that, so that would have been Evil Woman, I guess. We were thinking, what about our 70-pound schoolboy gig? Surely a band wouldn't do that when they're in the charts. We, at that point, were really worried that Sabbath wouldn't show, and that we'd get our heads kicked in by angry fans. Anyway, mid-afternoon, a truck pulled into the car park. It was Sabbath. We hadn't seen them in a while, and they had changed. Their hair was longer, they were wearing black granddad t-shirts and crucifixes, so classic Sabbath here. Actually, another side note here on the crosses, if I can recall correctly, there's a story behind why they started wearing those big gaudy crosses. After the debut with all that lovely witchcraft imagery, Black Sabbath had got a request from a group of Satanists who wanted them to perform at a worship ceremony, held in Stonehenge, I think, just to add to the mystique. And if you've ever wondered where Spinal Tap gets its ideas, it's all fucking Sabbath. Anyway, the band refused that request, and they were later informed that the cult leader had placed a hex on them. Probably someone taking the piss, but fearing for his life, Ozzy asked his dad to make him a metal cross. And then the other band members saw that, and they were like, oh, we want one too. So he made one for all the band members, and they wore them as protection or something like that. I don't know if that's a true story, but it was in Tony's book, I think. Anyway, back to this fan's letter. The hall was packed solid. Everyone had a great time. Sabbath was totally heavy. The atmosphere was really cool. Me and my mates were in the changing room, and somebody stuck 70 pounds in Tony's hand. I can't remember who it was, but one of us said to him that it was really good that they did the gig, even though they could have made far more money somewhere else. This is actually kind of telling of the fact that Sabbath were outgrowing the UK scene and Jim Simpson as their promoter. I mean, they shouldn't have been playing school dances at this point. There we go. The first installment of The Lovely Caravan, or Follow the Lovely Caravan, some shit like that. Let's get off the ride for a second. Oh, wait, I actually have a set list here, too. So this one is a couple of nights after that Cosmo gig that I just discussed. This is March 28th, 1970. But this is the first kind of complete set list that I could find. It's at a London gig, so you leave it to those city folk to write the shit down. So I would assume this is a similar kind of set list that they would have played at the time. You got Paranoid, Iron Man, NIB, Black Sabbath, which is like fucking greatest hits here. War Pigs, Hand of Doom, Fairies Wear Boots, a guitar solo, Behind the Wall of Sleep, and Rat Salad to close. So that's one of the earliest set lists. And looks almost like the end to it, right? Like, greatest hits, man. Just shows how iconic these first two albums were. Actually, this may be fun. Let's find the end set list now. And we'll do a little beginning versus the end here. 1 second. Okay, February 4th, 2017, Genting Arena, Birmingham. Much longer set, of course. Black Sabbath, Fairies Wear Boots, Under the Sun, After Forever, Into the Void, Snowblind, so they play a lot of mid-70s stuff there. Then War Pigs, Behind the Wall of Sleep, NIB, Hand of Doom. They do a little medley here. Super Not, Sabbath Play Sabbath, and Megalomania. Rat Salad. What is Rat Salad? That's one of their go-tos? Okay. Iron Man, Dirty Woman, Children of the Grave, Paranoid. So yeah, every track from the earlier set list was in the end set list. So also that summer, after a slew of underwhelming UK gigs, they finally part ways with Jim Simpson, left in the dust. And they get picked up by a real swinging dick manager, but I need to do more research on that whole deal. There's a lot of drama, there's a lot of legal stuff too. So I'll touch on that all next episode, because that leads into Master of Reality more. Let me grab the liner notes here. Okay, so recorded at Regent Sound and Island Studios. So they spent a bit more time on this one. Not much more, though. Quick turnaround still, because the album's first recording session was in the summer of 1970, and the debut was back in November 13th. So 3-4 months, maybe? Not long to get those new tracks together. What else is in here? All songs by Iommi, Osborne, Butler, Ward. Okay, that's not alphabetical, so I wonder if that was in the order of who gets the most credit for each song. Iommi, of course, demanding the lion's share there. Here we go. Produced by Roger Bain, as he should be after killing it on that debut. Same engineers, too, Tony Allom and Brian Humphreys, the lo-fi dream team. He also got original design and photography by Keith. Oh, yeah, let's talk about the cover here a bit. Now, the album was going to be called War Pigs, but they switched to Paranoid because they were paranoid that War Pigs was too political. And with songs like Hand of Doom, they were already pushing the Vietnam protest vibe a bit. Record Man doesn't want to try to sell that shit. But the cover, what the fuck is going on, man? People always say, well, it's obvious. They were going to call it War Pigs. Look at the cover. Really? A bloke dressed in a cape in his goddamn underpants with like a motorcycle helmet on, just tripping balls running through the forest. What the fuck does that have to do with War Pigs? Everything's in neon pink and the cape, the sword. Should have been called Neon Knights. Maybe Dio bought the album. He's like, man, they need to make a song about this guy. So the cover sounds pretty fucking stupid, right? But it works. It's fucking awesome. I mean, maybe it's because I grew up with it, but it seemed cool when I was a kid. So it's the same mastermind behind the Witchy Woman cover of the first LP who did this one. Marcus Keefe. He did some other iconic records and then switched to film. So here's some info on Keefe. Keefe Stewart McMillan, a.k.a. Keefe, is responsible for some of the most iconic album sleeves of the late 1960s and early 70s. His work rarely featured the album's artists. It was often an obscure reference to an album track, or even a completely random, yet striking concept that bore no reference to the album. Particularly renowned for his so-called false color photography, his sleeves often depicted pink foliage instead of green, creating a surreal landscape. He seems to work almost exclusively for Vertigo, so they would have assigned him, especially since the band was so hands-off at the time. The riffs on this offering are plenty. So where do I start? Well, fucking War Pigs, right? Track one, stupid. Originally called Walpurgis, a track that developed out of a call-and-response jam from Tony and Bill while playing live one night, that Geezer then rolled in and penned some witchy lyrics to fill the gaps, and boom, a new sinister track was born. And I think it's even better than Black Sabbath as a lead-off for the album. I know, that's blasphemy, right? But that first part in War Pigs, fuck, with the air raid siren. I think that would have been added later by Roger Bain. But it's so cool as an opener. And this was the first Sabbath record that I ever heard on my dad's turntable. So fucking good. Let's jump back to its beginnings. When it was called Walpurgis, you all know the generals gathered in their masses, the war protest lyrics. Well, here were the original words, not about war at all. And there's some recordings of this too. In particular, there's a session that they did with John Peel for the Top Gear radio program, which was sometime between the debut and Paranoid. So you got an early version of this, and Fairies as well. And fucking great recordings. But here's what the lyrics were. Witches gathered in black masses, bodies burning in red ashes. On the hill, a church in ruin, is the scene of evil doing. It's a place for all bad sinners. Watch them eating dead rats' innards. I guess it's the same wherever you go. Oh, Lord, yeah. That part remains. Oh, Lord, yeah. Naturally. Then they continue on with the Norwegian black metal here. Carry banners which denounce the Lord. See me rocking in my grave. See them anoint my head with dead rat's blood. See them stick the stake through me. So, there you go. Rats are a major theme here. Really driving home the horror with these lyrics, burning the witch. I mean, War Pigs' lyrics are great too, but this is better, right? At least for a horror junkie like myself. On the scene, a priest appears, sinners falling to his knees. Satan sends out funeral pyre, casts the priest into the fire. Oh, Lord, yeah. So let's play the riff here. Tony just hangs on those chords, and then Geezer's catching all kinds of magic underneath, right? He's doing these fantastic little hammer-on deals, standard tuning, maybe even a little sharp on the album. I really like the guitar on the verses, too. Let's skip to Ben's track on that. Man, that's a killer riff, how he palm mutes and hits those sharp 12th fret stabs. So fucking metal. Okay, so the next track, you get Paranoid. Shit, I don't even have to play this one. You all know this one, the big hit. It's funny that this is the song that's most associated with Black Sabbath because it's so quick and somewhat disposable. It's kind of a punky little thing. It's not like anything else in their catalog, really. Theme-wise, Geezer had this to say about Paranoid. He says, basically, it's just about depression, because I didn't really know the difference between depression and paranoia. It's a drug thing. When you're smoking a joint, you get totally paranoid about people. You can't relate to people. There's that crossover between the paranoia you get when you're smoking dope and the depression that comes afterwards. So, there you go. Take it as you will. I mean, they wrote it legitimately as filler, so I don't need to overanalyze the lyrical content on this song. But there's an energy to the song that's absolutely undeniable. And for that, I never skip it. Today, though, we will. Because the next one, this has become one of my all-time favorites now since starting the podcast. I never used to like this song. In fact, I often would skip over Paranoid and Caravan just to get to the glorious Iron Man Electric Funeral Two Punch of Doom. But now, this one's up there for me. I fucking love Caravan. It's so vibey. You gotta just trip to it. Playing a Caravan also on the deluxe version of Paranoid as a sort of scratch track vocal version, which is fucking hilarious, but it shows the process that Ozzy and Geezer are getting the lyrics down. How Ozzy would just kind of find the melody first and sing nonsense like, oh, you're so lovely, I want your body, stuff like that. And then Geezer, he would dive into his occult books and newspaper headlines and come out with badass lyrics about tripping out in the stars and shit. All kinds of magic in this song. I missed it the first time around, like I said, but since doing this podcast, Caravan has become one of my go-to tracks. And speaking of go-to tracks, next up, you get the pairing of Iron Man and Electric Funeral, breaking the chill vibe that's been set by Caravan. Okay, so I gotta give the power of the riff to Iron Man. How can I not?
Power of the riff compels me.
Electric Funeral would be a close second, actually, but this... I know it's played, I know it's simple, but I mean, who doesn't know how to play a version of this on the guitar? The track was just so inspirational, you know? I mean, coming up, learning how to play bass or guitar, and jamming with garage bands, everybody knows this. Sometimes riffs are cool when you can, like, do them yourself, you know? Or, like, a close approximation really easily. Like Smoke on the Water, Sunshine of Your Love. I mean, how many guitar shops have you been in and some kid is there riffing on Iron Man on some rig way out of his price range, like vintage Les Paul or some shit, just daydreaming? If you can do something like halfway play a riff, it's the next step to staying engaged with the instrument. Not that I made anything of it, but still, I have my bass here. I'm able to play some riffs through, help the show out. But I wouldn't have started playing at all if I was trying to shred some fucking Zakk Wylde solo on my first try, so... You gotta give it up for Iron Man and how they return to the big detuned at the end with the bass just cooking like. Yeah. Tony actually bends that low E string behind the nut on the headstock of the guitar. Like, I can't really do it with a bass. It's a cool trick. I wonder where he picked that up from. Was that something that he invented like everything else in hard rock? You just can't touch the Riff Lord from this point forward. I mean, Iron Man is the moment when he becomes the Riff Lord, I believe. Next level shit. Just a definition of plotting doom on this one. Well, shit, three tracks. Because he builds off of that power with Electric Funeral, just filling the fucking speakers. I guess you could consider this a deep cut, although they're all pretty much iconic from this LP. There's no real deep cuts on the Paranoid LP. Maybe Rat Salad, but even that, it's like Bill's Moby Dick, right? So you gotta love it. Funeral is one of my favorites, though. Listen to the doom in this riff. I should also talk about the special quad mix that this album was available in. Quadraphonic sound. Even the deluxe CD edition of this had a DVD with a surround sound mix that kind of approximated the original quadraphonic mix that would have been available in the 70s. Very few people would have heard that, as the systems were super expensive. And other than a few Pink Floyd and Allman Brothers albums, There weren't very many offerings on vinyl and quadraphonic. But Electric Funeral, it also ties into the war themes of this album. This one is about nuclear warfare. Here's the lyrics. Reflex in the sky, warn you that you're gonna die. Storm coming, you better hide from the atomic tide. Flashes in the sky, turns houses into sties, turns people into clay. Radiation, mind, decay. Fucking pure doom. And it doesn't let up. I love this verse, actually. Dying world of radiation, victims of man's frustration. Burning globe of obscene fire, like electric funeral fire. You can't top this one. And the doom doesn't stop there. It continues on, because next, it's the motherfucking Hand of Doom. I can take this one. Oh yeah. That's the second most played Sabbath bass riff of all time, right? First NIB, then this. Iconic geezer. The lyrics tie into war again. First it was the bomb, Vietnam, napalm, disillusioning, you push the needle in. The whole soldiers return, PTSD that comes with the drafted soldiers in Vietnam. A lot of them turned to heroin upon their return, or while they were there, as far as what I've gathered from all the Oliver Stone films. But the sound musically is kind of tripped out blues number. It's a lot like the debut song, actually. And I just love Bill Ward's drums. I mean, that rim shot, that laid back beat. Yeah, just the kick fucking pounding. I wish I could play the track here and give Bill some love. He's incredible on this entire B-side, actually. Such good drums, captured well by Roger Bain and company in the studio. I love the realness of that rusty beater kick drum that he's got going. And a bit of snare bleeding in when it's not supposed to. It's the perfect garage sound. And you can't recreate the magic that is Paranoid. Talking about the drum sound, there's not much point in going through Rat Salad here today with my resources. All that can be said is it's Nibby's goddamn Moby Dick, and it's fucking great. It might be the weakest track on Paranoid by default, as it's a little jammy, not particularly focused part-wise, and it's an instrumental too, so it comes off as the closest thing to filler on Paranoid. Which it's not, of course. It's still a classic Sabbath number, and they play it live too, well into the end tour, always giving their drummer a little bit of a showcase time to play along with it. But if that's the weakest song on the album, then fuck, man, what an LP. And we haven't even finished yet, because the closer is one of my favorites. Straight Fire, You Gotta Believe Me. Fairies Wear Boots. Ben just nailing this one. Some cool time signatures on this riff. Definitely up there in my favorites of this era. Man, the riffs. Such a twisted little shuffle on this one, right? Kind of falls in with their earlier vibes too, I feel. There's some evil blues in there. Like this one would have been right at home between, say, Behind the Wall of Sleep and Wicked World. But I mean, they were written in the same year, so obviously there's going to be some shared vibes, right? Ozzy had a big part in writing the lyrics on this one, apparently. It was about the skinheads that used to beat him and Geezer up in the clubs in Birmingham for being the long hairs. Although Ozzy actually had a skinhead kind of phase back in the day, if I do recall. So here's the lyrics. Going home late last night, suddenly I got a fright. Yeah, I looked through the window and surprised what I saw. A fairy with boots dancing out with a dwarf. Oh, right now. Sounds more like a drug trip to me. Fucking David Lynch, Twin Peaks scene. The inspiration was the skinheads and their Doc Martin boots. They've confirmed that many times. But Fairies is fucking amazing, musically. The song just blows my mind. I mean, I find something different every time I play it. The first of many perfect closers from the Sabs, too. There you have it. Another record down. And I haven't even finished my Pint of Doom. Oh well, wait till next installment. There's a lot to get to as far as the supporting tour for this album. As usual, leave me a review, subscribe if you like the show, and now I got that Twitter going, at SabbathBloodyPC. Check it out there, chime in, or keep it private, email me, sabbathbloodypodcast@gmail.com. Tell me how you're doing. Are you holding in there with me so far? Either way, fairies wear boots, man. So you got to believe me, all right? Bug blast all of you.